I don't understand. Why aren't you moving? What's the matter with you guys?
Those are British troops at Arnhem. They're hurt bad. You're not going to stop. Not now.
I'm sorry. We have our orders.
We busted our asses getting here. Half my men are killed, and you're just going to stop? And drink tea?
Look, we're now facing a completely different situation. We can't leave with tanks up that road. Jerry will pick us off like sitting ducks. Our infantry are still fighting in Nijmegen. When I get here, we'll move on.
For Christ's sake, must you do everything but a book?
Our orders are to wait for the infantry. I'm sorry, but there it is.
My name is Moffat Burris. I was a captain in 3rd Battalion, 504 Parachute Regiment, and commanded I Company, which is one of the two assault companies that made the river crossing and captured the bridge at Nijmegen. When we were first advised that we were going to be in that battle, we went up in this tall building, a factory electrical plant building, with General Horrocks and General Browning, Colonel Tucker, and the officers from the four company commanders and the S3 of the 3rd Battalion, 504, and made a visual reconnaissance and looking over the river and over the pasture and the dike where the machine guns were, railroad bridge where the 20-millimeter gun was. And I remember General Horrocks explaining the critical situation of the British troops in Arnhem, and that if we didn't get there and give them some assistance at the bridge, that in a matter of hours, all would be lost. And I remember Colonel Tucker responding to a comment that General Horrocks made when he said, General Horrocks asked Tucker, "Can your lads do the job? Can they get the bridge?" Colonel Tucker said, "Let me ask you a question, General. If we take that bridge, what assurance do we have from you that your tanks will be lined up for Arnhem in force?" And Horrocks, and I can remember his remarks as if they were yesterday, said, "My tanks will be lined up in full force, hell-bent for Arnhem, and nothing will stop them." That's not what happened. One gun stopped them. After we crossed the river and had 50% casualties in that crossing and made it up to the dike, knocked out the machine guns, and went on and captured the north end of the bridge, four British tanks came across. The lead tank was knocked out, and the other three backed up to the bridge. And I went to the commander of that task force, which was Captain Carrington, and said, "Why are you stopping?" And he said, "Well, I can't go up there. That gun will knock out the rest of my tanks." I said, "We will go with you and get that gun." He said, "No, I can't go without orders." And I said, "Well, I'm giving you orders." And an American captain giving a British captain orders went over like a lead balloon. And so he said, "No, I have to have orders from my British commander. Well, about that time, my frustration was turning to anger. And I can't repeat on the air what I said to him at that time, but it was not very complimentary. And they sat there all night, even after Colonel Tucker and Major Cook came and had a similar conversation with him. "Why aren't you moving on?" And so that was the situation up to that point. There's only one gun left. And what I couldn't understand, just a few hours before that, Horrocks had told us very explicitly, "My tanks will be lined up in full force, hell-bent for Arnhem." Four tanks went across. Not all of his tanks. Not 10, not 20, not 40 tanks, but four tanks went across. And when one got knocked out, they backed up and stopped. Why did they do that? I don't know. The information I have been told was that Carrington said his orders were to take the bridge and hold it for further orders. That was not what Horrocks told us the orders would be. So we were very, very frustrated sitting there all night, having sacrificed half of the men of my company to try to rescue the British paratroopers. We knew what it was like for paratroopers to fight Tiger tanks. We'd done it all through Sicily and Italy and the rest of the war, and it is not a comfortable feeling. So we had a great deal of compassion for the British paratroopers that were being mauled by the Tiger tanks. To send four tanks across, and he has an entire corps of tanks in Nijmegen, is just beyond belief. We were expecting to see the tanks roaring across the bridge at full speed, and that didn't happen. I can understand the 10 tanks that were supporting us when we were making the river crossing. Maybe I'd been told they were not there because they had expended all of their ammunition. But the rest of the tanks that were in Nijmegen, there should have been a full force of them going across that bridge and headed for Arnhem. The airborne paratroopers in Arnhem were just hanging on by their fingernails. And that was known by Horrocks and the other troops in Nijmegen. And why they would let that one gun stop them is just beyond belief to me. Well, we were in hopes that that's what would have occurred, that the war would have been over by Christmas. And had 30 Corps gone on into Arnhem and saved the paratroopers up there, that very easily could have happened. But there's just a different way in fighting between the American paratroopers. We were extremely aggressive, and we did not let anything stop us. We just kept going took opportunities, every opportunity possible to move forward. The British seemed to be more cautious in their movements, stop and tidy up the lines and get in a better fire away for a day or two and soften up the enemy troops. But that was not our way of fighting, and we did not have the time for that. We had a matter of a handful of hours to get to Arnhem to save the troops up there, and that didn't happen. Well, a good bit of fighting had gone on just prior to the bridge crossing, and Nijmegen was going up in flames at that time. But I would say that the Allied troops there, the 82nd Airborne and 30 Corps, were in charge of the city, and they should have been able to reorganize and get refueled and been across that bridge in a matter of less than an hour's time. But there again, that didn't happen. I've never seen any, heard any explanation that satisfied me. I didn't get any explanation as to why they didn't move on, other than the fact that they said, well, we only had these four tanks ready to go. The others were in traffic jams back in Nijmegen and getting refueled and ammunition and so forth. And that and the fact that the road was elevated and the tanks could not get off the road and that they would just be targets of the German anti-tank guns. And so they need to get them softened up before they moved on and get the forces all lined up, ready to go. They knew at the time that we just had a matter of 2 or 3 hours to get to Arnhem. And why they delayed is beyond me. I cannot explain it. Well, perhaps on the outskirts of Arnhem, they would have run into opposition and there would have been a tank battle. But the British knew when they jumped that that armored division was in Arnhem. I knew it was in Arnhem. I saw the photographs that had been taken by the Brits that physically showed the tanks. So they knew that they were going to run into that kind of opposition, and they expected that with the armored corps that they would be able to handle it. And that did not happen. And as I was talking to Carrington, he was sitting in his tank, and we were having this argument about him not moving out, and when he failed to move, and I ordered him to, and he still failed to move, I cocked my Tommy gun and put it to his head and told him if he didn't get this blankety-blank tank moving, I'd blow his head off. And with that, he ducks down into the tank, closes the hatch, and sits there the rest of the night, couldn't get to him. As I understand, Carrington denies that anybody pulled a gun on him, but his memory is not quite as good as mine if he really believes that. I bumped into Carrington at the 65th anniversary celebration at a reception that we're having for the Queen. And as he walked up, General Petraeus and I were talking, and he introduced me to Carrington, and I said, "Well, we know each other. We met on the bridge 65 years ago." And Carrington turned and looked at me, and he said, "Oh, you're the chap that called me a yellow-livered coward." And I said, "Is that what I called you?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "You didn't really expect me to follow the orders of a foreign government, did you?" And I said, "Of course I did." And then it went on from some small talk from that point. I may have been too hard on Carrington if his orders from Horrocks were to cross the bridge and hold it for further order. That's what I have heard. Whether that is authentic or not, I do not know. But I had heard that.
My name is Robert Kershaw, and I'm the author of It Never Snows in September, which I wrote some time ago when I was still serving in the Army. I speak and read German. I attended the German Staff College, and I was requested by the British Staff College to see if I could assist them with a battlefield tour that they were doing with British veterans in and around Arnhem. And the question for me was, could I interview some Germans or find some Germans for them to attend and be interviewed? Well, in the event, that was not possible. And I was actually working with the German army, the Bundeswehr, at the time. And they agreed to get information together for this particular event. And a whole flood of very personal papers, letters, and accounts came in, which fascinated us all, and that was the stuff that I used on an initial battlefield tour in Arnhem, and much later they persuaded me subsequently to write a book and include all this material.
Now, your book isn't quite as famous as Corlinus Ryan's A Bridge Too Far. Maybe it wasn't A Bridge Too Far.
The Corlinus Ryan book was a process where he employed a lot of researchers to get him the information. He was an ex correspondent, a very good writer, but he was really writing accounts that have been gathered by many other researchers as well. And a lot of myth has since grown up, primarily as a consequence of his book and the slightly inaccurate interpretation of it that came with the big film A Bridge Too Far. I remember speaking with a British military advisor who worked with Joseph E. Levine on that film, and he said, just bear in mind, Colonel, the chap was an ex-retired colonel, I make films for money, not for history. And that is very true, and there are incidents within the film that have been glossed over for their dramatic effect and are not particularly accurate. The operation was a huge risk, and I think probably the Allies at the time were justified in taking it. A lot of the comment about Arnhem has been with the benefit of armchair hindsight, and you really got to try and get back to the times when the German army was visibly collapsing after the debacle in Normandy. They'd retreated in great haste into southern Holland, and it appeared that just one more shove would bring the whole edifice crashing down. The British airborne formations waiting for action in the UK were itching for a chance to get into the fight, and this particular division hadn't seen action since Italy about a year and a half before, and they felt that the war might indeed be passing them by. They'd been stood up for a large number of operations that actually hadn't happened, so they were very anxious to get in. And with the information that was available, it appeared, despite factual data that there were German units consolidating in around Arnhem, there was a feeling, okay, but they would probably be swept aside in the next major offensive. I'm an ex-parachute regiment officer myself, and we would always want to be dropped both sides of the bridge if there was an assault where you wanted to take it. The problem is, an airborne operation of this size is a massive and highly technical, complex undertaking. There was a belief that you can actually land nearer the bridge, but when you look at the geography of the place, particularly in 1944, the area around Arnhem was surrounded by polderland, low-lying marsh, so you couldn't get gliders close into the bridge. You might get paratroopers. There was also a large amount of flak around Dieland Airfield, which was just to the north of Arnhem itself. And for all those sort of reasons, and the lessons that have been derived from extremely heavy casualties suffered by the airborne in Normandy, was that really a landing under fire was not a viable option. So they opted to land further away from the bridge to enable themselves to land as a cohesive group and then move in on Arnhem. And interestingly, Model, the German army group commander responsible for the defence of the area, himself thought that was quite a good idea, because they had no idea what the British were doing, because the landings were cloaked by the woods between Arnhem and Oosterbeek, and they thought actually this was quite a clever ploy, landing in the vicinity, because they had no idea really where the British might be going. Of course, all the logic dictated toward the bridge, but they were not absolutely certain initially. The film actually portrays the American paratroopers capturing the bridge. That is not entirely true. It was a joint operation. Actually, the British tanks got across the bridge 45 minutes before the American paratroopers arrived at the northern end. And the British tanks actually met the paratroopers in the village of Lent on the far side. But because it was a joint operation, that is why both those elements succeeded. The tanks wouldn't have got across, and neither would the Americans probably have captured the bridge, but for that happening at the same time. So that was a slightly glossed over bit of myth, really, from the point of view of the filmmakers. Once they had captured the bridge, and this is debatable, they could conceivably have pushed an armoured infantry group up the road to reach Arnhem. But at the same time, the Arnhem Bridge had just been captured by the Germans. So in any event, both captures were a hollow victory. But I interviewed the German SS general, Hamel, who was responsible for the defence of the bridge, and he gave me an artillery map. And artillery maps will always show the location of friendly units. And it's obvious from this particular map and his statements that there was very little on the road between Nijmegen and Arnhem at that time. In fact, there appears to be only a couple of companies of infantry security pickets in the village of Elst, which is midway between the two. So it is just conceivable that they may have been able to push an armoured battle group up that road. Harmel thinks so, because he very sarcastically said, and the British stop for tea. And that's the version also that the Americans would have you believe. I'm an armchair strategist, talking in hindsight, and he was the man there at the time. If he says that the psychological impact of a unit pushing down that road could have been decisive, then I think you have to listen. That is quite possible. Fact and fiction over these sort of 60 odd years will always tell a different story. Harmel was a very clear and precise and man. He gave the impression when he spoke to me, he was smoking a huge cigar, puffing smoke all over me, and he gave me a very clear exposition of his defence of Nijmegen and Arnhem. He was responsible for both bridges because it made sense. One was reinforcing the other. And he actually told me things that were not in Cornelius Ryan's book, and I pointed this out to him, and he actually said to me, well, I told Cornelius Ryan this stuff, and he interpreted it in a different way. For example, I pointed out that Harmel was in the bunker and able to see the Nijmegen Bridge, and he said, well, no, I wasn't in the bunker. I was actually conducting the battle from a Volkswagen Jeep, because he was switching between the two lakes. Locations. He had to fight the Arnhem Bridge free and defend the Nijmegen Bridge. So he was driving up and down the 10 kilometres between the two locations, constantly coordinating the battle. So being a soldier myself, all that had a ring of truth to it. So what he told me, I found interesting and probably authentic. But you really have got to also bear in mind that behind the advance, the airborne corridor had already been cut. It was to be cut very seriously again over the next subsequent 2 and 3 days. And all the infantry that the Brits had at the time were still fighting for possession of Nijmegen. They'd captured the bridge, but they hadn't captured the town. And really, they were stretched out piecemeal between Nijmegen, the Groesbeek Heights, and the Grave Bridge that was captured further down the road. So it's very debatable whether, even if an armour group had pushed up the road, that the British would have had the resources to reinforce it and back it up, because the corridor was already being blocked by German attacks further to the south. There are two schools of thought. There's the German Harmel's view, which says that they could have got through, and that is backed up by the evidence from the artillery maps that still exist of the situation at that time. Between 7 o'clock, when the bridge was captured, and midnight that night, the Germans managed to get some 2 battalions and 16 tanks in place to block the road leading up to Elst. By dawn the following day, they'd shifted 5 battalions and some 25 tanks across the Arnhem Bridge into the island feature on the other side, and they effectively blocked the British when they got going the following morning. From the British perspective, they'd just captured this bridge. Only six tanks got across. Two of them were knocked out on the way, so there are only four in the village of Lent on the other side, and they were reinforced by the remnants, the survivors of that very heroic Salt River crossing that the American 82nd Battalion had accomplished. So they were actually very short of troops and tanks, and they would certainly have been anticipating a heavy counterattack coming in, because traditionally that is what had happened thus far in the campaign between Normandy and where they were now. But the Germans didn't have the resources to do this. At the same time, the four tanks across the bridge had only tenuous contact with the guards in Nijmegen on the other side. Lord Carrington, who was the second in command of the squadron that made that crossing, was responsible for the radio relay between the two. And the Guards infantry were still very much fighting in Nijmegen. The Coldstream Guards, who were also nearby, were with the American paratroopers defending the Groesbeek Heights, so they weren't available. The Welsh Guards were assisting guarding the Grave Bridge, and the rest of the Guards in Nijmegen themselves itself were fighting to the west of the railway bridge, where they had fired in the American paratrooper Salt River crossing and were engaged to the west of Nijmegen, blocking German forces there. So from the British perspective, they had simply run out of momentum. They could be perhaps criticised for not having a plan. What happens should you take the bridge? But they in no way bounced the bridge. This was a deliberate attack, and they couldn't be certain that they would indeed capture it. So it wasn't part of the plan. The real opportunity that was lost, I suppose, is possibly the psychological impact of pushing a unit up the road after 7 o'clock, if one had been available. But the real lost opportunity was the fact that the Americans decided not to give the Nijmegen Bridge the top priority on the first day, which is when they landed on the 17th of September. They instead put their weight behind the defence of the Groesbeek Heights, which is to the east of Nijmegen. I think the what-if arguments tend to cloud the judgment that people were exercising at the time. There was a belief that the German defence would collapse, and I think that is a viable belief when you read the evidence of the time, but it just didn't go that way, and it's human nature that it perhaps did not. The Battle of Arnhem was not a series of Allied errors so much as the Germans were unexpectedly effective in providing the amount of resistance that was going to block the move, and all that was unexpected. And what is very interesting about Montgomery, it was a very daring plan, but Montgomery seems to have stepped back as soon as the operation had started and was starting to go wrong, and maybe he sensed that it was going to go wrong, because the Germans were providing really that much of a crust that was totally unanticipated. So I don't really buy the line that the problems at Arnhem were this great litany of Allied mistakes. I think they were unexpectedly confronted by far more serious German resistance than they anticipated, and they simply didn't have the resources as a consequence to carry it through. Even if they had got there and they had relieved the British forces on the north side of the river, they were exhausted and they would not have had the resources to exploit the advantage that they would have achieved, because up until the 26th of September, bearing in mind that the bridge was captured on the 20th of September, the Arnhem Bridge by the Germans and the Nijmegen by the British, the corridor was cut three times for as long as 24, nearly 48 hours to the south. So they probably would not have been in a position to exploit beyond the bridgehead. I think a lot of the British accounts since the war have really overplayed the catastrophic find that it was thought that they would be brushing aside resistance, those mistakes were probably, those errors are understandable and worthwhile, bearing in mind that this is the nearly the fifth year of the war and they want to get it done. And they got it wrong.
My name's Tim Lynch, and my book, Operation Market Garden, The Legend of the Vaal Crossing, is about the Battle of Nijmegen and the crossing of the river by the 82nd Airborne. And it looks really at the story that's grown up around that crossing, and particularly in respect of 30 Corps' advance to Arnhem. It's absolutely a heroic crossing. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But the fact is, it was completely unnecessary. Had the 82nd actually achieved their objective on D-Day, the crossing would not have been necessary. It was something that the British had made contingency plans for, but for the 43rd Division to do the crossing rather than the 82nd, it was just that the 82nd happened to be there at the time. One of the main controversies about the entire Operation Market Garden, you get a lot of criticism about the British dropping too far from Arnhem, disregarding the fact that the 82nd dropped too far from the Nijmegen Bridge too. But although the criticism usually looks at the Air Force and says that it's the Air Force's fault, when you look back at the history of airborne operations, Sicily, Normandy, and the south of France in August of 1944, they'd all been very scattered jumps. And so there's evidence to say that the airborne themselves wanted to be put down in complete units, which meant that they had to go for drop zones that were a long way from their targets.
Now, the obvious thing to do is to put your paratroopers as close as possible to the objective. So why didn't they do that?
Because the paratroopers were more interested in landing as a complete formed unit, and they were willing to sacrifice the distance for the fact that they would be formed when they landed rather than scattered as they had been over previous jumps. One of the interesting questions that crops up all the time is, could 30 Corps have gone on the night of the 20th? And, yeah, technically, they could have gone on. The real question, though, is what could they have achieved by going on that night? And the answer is, not a great deal. By that time, the German counterattack was building up, and the very, very real danger that Horrocks faced was that his men would be cut off in Arnhem with the paratroopers and destroyed in detail. The real problem with Operation Market Garden is that it's billed as laying an airborne carpet for the tanks to roll over. It didn't do that. And the tanks were actually forced to fight their own way up to as far as Nijmegen. So by the time they got there and got across the river, they were scattered all over the place, particularly around Nijmegen, fighting a battle to control the bridge that should have been held for them by the time they arrived. There's this thesis that there's nothing to stop them. There's also the official US history that says that there was an SS battalion, 11 tanks, another infantry battalion, two batteries of 88s, 20 mm guns. That doesn't sound like virtually nothing. The road north of Nijmegen, according to the intelligence briefings at the time, coming off the road, ranged from, quote, impractical to impossible. They were confined to the road, and you don't need a lot of guns to deny a road to a tank. So this idea that they seem to have to crack on doesn't hold water, nor does it take into account the fact that the division was completely off balance because it was fighting the Battle of Nijmegen that it shouldn't have been fighting.
Moffat Burries says he was speaking to Horrocks and the commanders in the electricity station in Nijmegen, and they promised him that if he managed to take the bridge, nothing would stop them charging forth to Arnhem to relieve the 1st Airborne.
I don't know whether that conversation took place. What I do know is that Burries was in I Company and says that they were promised on the night of the 19th that they were going to go and the tanks were going to be ready. Captain Carl Kappel, who was in charge of H Company, who would also be making the crossing in the first wave, says that he wasn't even told about the crossing until 9 o'clock the next morning. So the question is, why was Berry's promised all this stuff by the generals at that meeting the night before, when his colleague, who had the same role, wasn't even informed about the meeting, let alone part of it? I think, again, going back to Captain Kappel, he was writing in 1949 at the School of Infantry at Fort Benning, and he said, as far as he was concerned, it was a great plan, and it very, very nearly worked. What I think is that it wasn't in American interests for it to actually succeed. Had Patton been in charge of that plan, it would have worked. Not because he was a great general, because he wasn't, but because there would have been no qualms about stopping the British dead in order to supply the single thrust. In order to support Market Yarden, Eisenhower was faced with a choice, and it was put as simply as this: you either stop with the left and punch with the right, or stop with the right and punch with the left. You can't do both. Patton was getting a lot of attention for his sweep across France. I mean, there'd been virtually nothing there to stop him getting there in the first place. But he insisted on getting so involved that they couldn't then stop the supplies to his army, which meant that rather than putting all the weight behind Montgomery's thrust north, they were splitting the supplies so that the supplies were going to Patton and to Montgomery. Had that been the other way around, there would have been no problem about stopping the British dead. As it was, Market Garden did not get the full weight of support that it should have done in order to succeed. It was a very daring plan, and it was the right plan, because what it would have done is swing the armies up and around the Siegfried Line and into Germany. What you had instead was Patton down at Metz battering away at fortified defences, losing thousands and thousands of troops and gaining nothing. And in the end, they simply went, well, fair enough, and we'll bypass it. Market Garden could have succeeded, should have succeeded, but the will to support it let it down. Look at 30 Corps' advance to Nijmegen. We're told they set off late. They didn't. They set off exactly at the time that they were supposed to. They didn't meet up with the 101st south of Somme because the 101st, according to an American study, didn't advance, and for no good reason. The 82nd had made no real effort whatsoever to actually achieve their primary objective. So that meant another 36 hours of fighting to capture a bridge that should have been waiting for them. You look at Brereton's support of the operation. He won't allow his air crews to fly an all-out effort. He's protecting his planes. So instead of this thunderclap surprise that he claims that he's trying to achieve, you've actually got 3 days of resupply, which, when you look at it, the plan called for 30 Corps to be through Nijmegen before the troops had finished arriving to actually secure the place for them. So there is this. I'm not suggesting for a second that some sort of conspiracy and they all got together and said, how do we screw up this plan? There's a lot that could go wrong, and a lot did go wrong. But you also have so many generals holding onto the steering wheel that no one is in overall control. Brereton is in charge of the airborne army. He's in conflict with Browning, who's also in conflict with Ridgway. Ridgway is supported by Taylor and by Gavin, the two crucial commanders in the first part of this operation. There's a lot of pressure on from Bradley and from Patton to mess up airborne operations, which they had done. They had deliberately sabotaged them in the past. And all this comes together to the sense of these guys were not working to the same aim. They weren't thinking from the same song sheet, if you want to put it that way. Everybody was trying to do their own little thing in their own little way without any thought for how that was going to impact on the overall plan.
You've explained how you think we came very close to it being a successful operation, ultimately. How would that have changed the course of events on the Western Front in the Second World War if they had succeeded in holding that bridge?
What it would have done is it would have shifted the balance of power. It would have meant that Montgomery had been proved right, and it would have meant that they would have had to have looked at supporting him rather than the broad front strategy that they were trying to achieve. That was completely unacceptable. It was an election year in the States. The Americans had to be seen to be winning the war. You need to remember that in 1943, Harry Butcher, who was one of Eisenhower's aides, had actually gone to the British in North Africa and said, look, situation's this. If we are not seen to be capturing places, the American public will want the American army to go home. We have to be part of the victory here, or we pack up and go home. And so certainly the capture of Tunis was delayed in order to accommodate that. Then in 1944, you have the problem in Italy, where Mark Clark says, not only am I going to ignore the plan, but if any Brit gets in the way of my troops and tries to get to Rome before me, I will have him shot. That kind of mentality had taken a very, very deep hold. So you've got election year, you've got this need for America to be seen to be winning, you've got Patton, who is very, very keen on self-publicity, and that combination meant the broad front strategy had to be maintained. Had our market garden worked, then there would have been a clear path into Germany, into the Ruhr, but it would have been led by the British, and that was completely unacceptable. It could have been a war-winning move had it been fully supported and had the idea that Montgomery had about delivering a series of colossal cracks, as he put it, actually been implemented. As it was a case of a very scattergun approach, and nowhere were the Allies actually strong enough to break through the Siegfried line.